Welcome to The Babblery, conversations where we explore the knowledge, opinions, passions, and obsessions of my guests. This is Suki Wessling, and today's program was recorded for Talk of the Bay on KSQD 90.7 FM Santa Cruz, California, streaming online at www.ksqd.org. When my co-host Christine mentioned the idea of linking the fight for legal midwifery in the 70s with today's struggle for abortion rights, I thought it was an intriguing idea. But what would midwives, whose lives are dedicated to celebrating pregnancy and birth, think about the idea? It turns out I didn't need to worry about this. Our two guests, Kate Boland and Raven Lang, not only dedicated their lives to healthy childbirth, but also to women's bodily autonomy in general. As Kate said during her discussion, she believes that a woman has a right to control over who touches me, as well as control over what goes into me and what comes out of me. That pretty much sums it up. Laws against appropriate health care for women are fundamentally devised to take personal agency away from women, instead of trusting that women can make the best choices for their health and the health of their potential children. Laws against midwifery and abortion both assume that women's bodies belong to the collective. No such laws exist for men. This conversation included two women in their 70s and two in their 50s. We kept mentioning what we hoped about younger women and wondered about them. I hope some of you listening are still in your childbearing years and that this conversation gives you some food for thought and some access to your own fiery, uppity, righteous young woman who will risk everything the way that Kate and Raven did to ensure women's bodily autonomy in our law and culture. Listen in. Welcome to Talk of the Bay, KSQD's local news program brought to you every weekday at 5 p.m. I'm your host, Suki Wessling.
And I'm your co-host, Christine Barrington.
Today, Christine and I are continuing our exploration of the post-Roe abortion debate from yet another angle. We have covered the topic from the point of view of physical and mental health, history and political action, and social stigma. At the end of the month, we'll feature a panel discussion with faith leaders about abortion and faith. You'll be able to access the whole series from the podcast of today's discussion, which will be available later on ksqd.org. Today, our focus actually starts with childbirth and works backwards to the question of women's bodily autonomy. We are going to explore the significant gains that are achieved when women are allowed to exercise greater leadership when it comes to their bodily autonomy. You may not know it, but Santa Cruz was ground zero in the effort to legalize midwifery in the 1970s. It's a thrilling tale with important outcomes for thousands of Californians, so important that most people don't even know that midwifery was illegal so recently. Today, we will speak with two of the significant players who made it possible. And we will also have links on the podcast page to this recording with information that will give you links to a video so you can learn the history that we are just going to touch on briefly while we talk about other things. In the studio, we're joined by Kate Boland, whose long career as a midwife started when, in her words, she was a fiery, uppity, righteous young woman. Kate helped deliver 1,789 local babies in her 50 years as a midwife in Santa Cruz County, the vast majority through home births. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
Using our remote feed, we are joined by Raven Lang, who founded the Santa Cruz Birth Center, the first birth center in North America in 1970. Raven was inspired to learn about natural childbirth after her own typical hospital birth experience in the 60s. She wrote the first book about home birth, The Birth Book, and also a book about traditional Chinese medicine. Welcome, Raven.
Thank you, and it is an honor to be here as well.
Raven and Kate, before we go back to the past so that we can connect it to the present, I'd love to hear your views on the meaning of the phrase women's bodily autonomy. What does that even mean? What does bodily autonomy mean to you? Why don't we start with Raven?
Self-control. Having a say in your body, having a say with what's happening. That's what it means to me.
Okay. All right. That's very straightforward and direct, definitely. And Kate?
I would say that I would have control over who touches me and how they touch me and who goes into me and who comes out of me and how and where and when.
I love what you just said, who goes into me and who comes out of me, because that is one of the things that connects our lives as sexual beings and our lives as people who give birth to babies. And it's so important for us to think about that fact, that bodily autonomy, something that is just assumed by men as being one of the rights we're given, their bodies are not subjected to the same things and don't do the same things that women's bodies do. So, you know, it's something to I wanted to start with that because I really think we've been chatting here in the studio before the show about how much has happened in your lifetimes and how Kate and Raven are in the age range of our mothers, and we are, Christine and I are both in our 50s, and then there's all these young women now of childbearing age who are going through a sort of it's not a return, but
they're going through an initiation.
Yeah.
Into the realities of maybe what we want to call patriarchy or what we want to call sort of the domination paradigm that humanity's been living with for a long time. They're getting initiated into a real shocking reality that actually was the reality for women not so long ago.
They don't have control.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When I was a young woman and just began menstruating, I lived in New Orleans, and women were chattel. They were possessions of their husbands in Louisiana.
And how did you see that?
I didn't really understand it. Mm-hmm. I was 13, you know. Mm-hmm. I understand it now. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole Southern culture is so... I don't even want to talk about it.
Okay, well, we won't talk about it.
But even here in California, in the whole country, women couldn't get credit cards in their own names.
Oh, right. Yeah.
When my sister...
Bank accounts.
...was living in North Carolina in the 80s, they didn't want to put her on the title to their house unless she changed her name to her husband's.
Yeah.
Raven, were you piping up there?
I just said, oh boy.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit, both of you, about what it was like for you as a young woman and for other young women you knew to know that you did not have bodily autonomy in the literal case of living in a state where you were literally legally chattel, to the more sort of social sense of knowing that you were unprotected from the point of view of other people, that you were to be used. What was it like for you then? Kate, you want to start?
Not really.
Okay, I'll pass that one to Raven. Raven, talk a little bit about what it was like at that time.
Well, when I was, you know, graduating high school, 1960 is when I graduated high school, that was the beginning of the birth control pill. And the girls who got pregnant in those days had to have a baby, period, end of story. There was no such thing as abortion in my mind. I went for 12 years to a Catholic convent education, and we were taught to, you know, go forth and multiply. And that never sat with me, nor did I ever totally embrace the whole Catholicism piece. And so I was slightly rebellious in that way. But the few girls who did get pregnant had babies, and they were saddled with the responsibility of it pretty much on their own. And that was simply something that we took for granted. We just took it for granted. A couple of years later, when I was working at the Bank of America, I met a woman, a young woman, my age. Well, she was maybe 2 years older than I. And she had just come back from Mexico, having had an illegal abortion in Mexico. And that was the, that was sort of the epiphany for me, like, whoa, this is something that is available. This is something somebody can do. And of course, it was completely covered with darkness. You know, having to go, she went to Tijuana. She went somewhere where she didn't know where she was going, didn't know who she was seeing, etc. And that became sort of, you know, shadowed in darkness and fear. Mm-hmm. And and then that was probably 1962. In 1968, I gave birth. And one of the things I had read was there were two books out in those days. And one of them was by a doctor who lived in England in the Second World War. And he went to deliver a baby to a young woman. And she had this beautiful birth. And he was just blown away, you know, how did she have this wonderful birth? And he said to her after it was all over, he goes, God, I don't know how you did it so well. You know, you seem so relaxed and you seem so happy. And how did you deal with the pain? And she looked at him and she said, was it supposed to hurt? and that was right. For me, a seed. You know, I read that when I was pregnant with my child, and pretty much what had been taught to me was that birth was gnarly. It was something that you don't look forward to. It was something that hurt, and if you were lucky, they could maybe give you medication. But, you know, there were mm-hmm. these two little books that were coming out talking about natural birth, and I gravitated toward them uh-huh. and asked for that. And I did get that. Uh-huh. And I did labor mostly outside of the hospital for a first baby. Wow. I went in about 4 hours before he was born. Uh-huh. And from the time I went there until he was born, what Kate said at the beginning, you give permission of who goes into you and who comes out of you.
Yeah.
I was in there for 4 hours, and I will guess that maybe I had 100 vag exams because I was I was in the rotation for young doctors learning
oh, yes.
how. Mm-hmm. And so every 15 minutes, somebody would come in. And even though my labor up until that point was wonderful, the experience that I mean, that's where the autonomy, the word autonomy comes mm-hmm. in, because I had none.
Yeah.
And I remember at one point pleading. I said to one of the physicians, I am begging you to stop this.
Yeah.
You know, but I had no right. I had no control.
Yeah.
I was disempowered in the experience. And, you know, then... Well,
hang on a second. Kate, go ahead.
Well, I was just going back to the question about what our experience was as women, young women. And unlike Raven, I had a mother who praised birth. Loved giving birth, was a real what I would call naturalist. And she also taught me that sex was wonderful, but not until you're married. And she gave me a book called Don'ts for Girls, which was don't go anywhere with a young man alone.
Right.
And so I had this positive input. On the other hand, I knew that her sister, they lived in Ann Arbor, her older sister had an abortion on the back porch, which would have been, you know, in the 20s.
That's, on the back porch. Wow.
Yeah, so the family doctor came and performed an abortion. So I knew that abortion was available to rich people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. A possibility.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It could be a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, and you know, when you asked Suki that question of what's bodily autonomy, and each person gave a piece of the answer, and the piece that was speaking in my heart was what Raven just spoke to, which is bodily sovereignty and autonomy over your body also means you get a say in how you're treated. Mm-hmm. When you're being medically examined or when you're giving birth, you have a say in how it's going to go. I was just reading an article in The Guardian, and I think the title was... they aren't hearing what we're saying. And it was about the experience of Black women in hospitals and how much they aren't listened to. And the death rate is so much higher for Black women because they're listened to and treated differently, right, when they go in the hospital. So
Yeah. We had that experience with Serena Williams.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, she gave birth. She said something is really wrong, and they didn't pay attention to her. I'm sure it was because she was black.
Well, also, I'll just say, because one of my friends just worked on the maternal mortality project in California, and listening to her for years and working on the issue myself, I'll just say this. We lose women because we do not have a health care system. Mm-hmm. You walk out of the hospital 3 days after birth, mm-hmm. and you don't see anybody for 6 weeks, and after 6 weeks, you don't see anybody. And many of the black women's deaths are due to cardiac problems mm-hmm. that are not diagnosed or treated. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge problem, and we have to really look at it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think you're probably going to really get into this, but Kate and Raven, the two of you, were sort of at this epicenter of advocating for the legalization of midwifery. And Raven wrote a book, right, called the Birth Book?
Correct.
Yes. Yeah, and Raven, and you were talking about begging these physicians to stop these vaginal exams, and you were also talking about how this young woman wasn't afraid, and so she gave birth peacefully, right? Beautifully. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in that book, you printed a poem about fear, right?
Yes.
And that when you're not afraid, right, that what happens to you, you don't experience as much pain. And I'm just going to read this poem because I think it really relates now to what we're facing with this abortion issue. And all of us are facing, like, if we try to help women, if we try to intercede, if we speak out, what could happen to all of us, right? So I wanted to read this poem, Raven, from your book, The Birth Book. I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over and through me. When it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. Where it has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain. And I loved that. And I've been so inspired by the courage that the two of you and so many other women at this inflection point in history here in California, where you stood up and said, even though this is illegal, we're going to do something. We're going to do this thing that is illegal, mm-hmm. and we're going to change it. And that just speaks to this moment, right?
It does.
It sure
yeah.
does. Mm-hmm.
And so this is an interesting thing to, before I ask you this question, I'm going to point out that right now, physicians all over this country, not just OBs, but all sorts of types of physicians who are treating pregnant women are having to make decisions for political reasons rather than medical reasons. And they're having to call lawyers in order to decide whether a woman is almost dead enough or whether a fetus has been gone long enough that they can get the dead tissue out, these sorts of questions. And they're concerned. So both of you started midwifery when you could be concerned about being in jail. Raven, talk a little bit about why you did it, even though you knew you'd get arrested.
It was needed. It was so severely needed. And I come from a family of sort of people who push through things. And I think it was just in my genetic makeup. I also was also brought up in a family where girls and boys, my mother is, I'm basically a first generation, and boys were treated very differently than girls. Mm-hmm. And so the inequities of gender were always, I think they were there when I was crawling and learning how to walk. And so I felt so deeply the need for women to be given a chance. I didn't recognize when I was in my early 20s that it was a patriarchal world. I mean, that came with maturity and looking at history. But I just automatically fought against it, you know. And when I had my first child, I came out of it saying something is deeply wrong. Something is very wrong. There was no such thing then as rooming in. And so the whole reunion of the mother to the child, or even the reunion of the family, the parents and the child, was absent. And I intuitively knew, because I'd studied a little biology, about bonding. The word bonding wasn't yet. It was called imprinting. Mm-hmm. If you look in my book, the chapter on imprinting would now be called bonding. Mm-hmm. So bonding wasn't even there. But I just knew that there were wrong things. And so I set out to educate women that they should reach for the moon if they wanted to have a good birth and be damned with whoever got in their way to just push for it and demand it. At one point, I was visited by Santa Cruz Public Health Department, and they came and knocked on my door and said, "You're a childbirth educator." And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Who gave you permission to do that?" And I said, "I gave myself permission to do that." They said, "Well, we're here to tell you, you're not allowed. So you have to cease and desist as of right now." And I said to them, there were two women there, and I said, "You know what? You set up a program where you're teaching that to women," because this is 1968 Santa Cruz. The university was young. And a lot of young people were coming in. Babies were beginning to be born in Santa Cruz, where previous it had been more of a retirement community. Mm-hmm. And, you provide that, and I will cease. But until it's provided for the young women, do what you want to me, I'm going to continue to do it. And I just pushed ahead.
I really love what Celeste Phillips was a nurse in Dominican, and she came to the birth center early on, and she realized there were more women at the birth center, which Raven started, having babies than there were at Dominican Hospital. And she decided she had to learn something.
Yeah, and just to offer our listeners even a little bit more context, people hear birth center, and they may not realize that this was sort of a clandestine, out-in-the-open thing, but illegal, right?
We were lay midwives, and we met in a Victorian house, and we shared knowledge.
Yeah, right on Escalona here.
Yeah, and several other locations, and we educated women and their partners and their families on, and a lot of it was like how to give birth and how to catch a baby.
So, we're going to take a little break, and we are going to continue this conversation, which is so fascinating. We are talking to two very, very skilled midwives. We have Kate Bowman and Raven Lang here, and they're going to return in a couple minutes, and we're going to start talking about how this experience relates to now, and how we've gotten from there to here, which is sort of there too. So stay tuned. We will be back in a moment. Thank you, Christine. I wanted to mention that we have a whole series of shows going on here at K-Squid about in response to the Supreme Court Dobbs decision. And we are interviewing such fabulous and interesting people. And I really recommend that you go to the podcast page for this show after our show ends and go take a look at the other shows that I will link to, because there's just so much interesting stuff happening. And I'll tell you about another one at our next break. So here we are. We are talking about midwifery. So midwifery was illegal, and you two were doing this illegal thing, and then...
And I'm wondering if listeners are as shocked as I am to learn that midwifery was illegal after Roe v. Wade was overturned, right? You could get...
Let me just give a brief history if I can take 60 seconds.
Go for it.
In the early 1900s, when the AMA formed, the first thing they did was make illegal midwifery, because if a young doctor did a birth for a family, he became a the go-to doctor for the rest of that family's life. So that was a way to build your practice. So it was economic to begin with. And then through time, they made obstetrics a specialty, and they completely cut out midwifery, which is a real crime. It's a real sad thing, because it was so medicalized that the way the human body works so beautifully, 90% of the time, was eliminated, that kind of care and that body of knowledge shrank to almost nothing. And so when we came out, when Ravens realized it could be different and started the birth center, it was so radical. It was the time that it's just do it. And by that time, the last licensed midwives in this state had been incarcerated in the Second World War because they were primarily Japanese. And so we lost our educated professional midwives. And Raven and other women like her across the country started with nothing but friendly doctors and OB books.
And there were no OB books.
Isn't that, that is just extraordinary, right?
It is. Yeah.
That women knowing, having this innate sense, like get some book learning and this thing that we do naturally, give birth, and we can, and women have been helping women do this for time immemorial.
Right, and there was professional midwifery in Japan, in Italy, and China, and I forget all the other countries, Russia. It was, and there were books about it that are very old. But in the United States, it was illegal. So it did survive in the South in the black midwives. But primarily, they were not book people. Mm-hmm. And they were black, so everything was discounted as the grannies, right? Meanwhile, we're out here on the coast. We don't really know about the grannies. We know that, you know, Raven knew that it was just do it. And so she just did it.
Well, I got a book on goat husbandry because I got some goats and I bred them and I read them. I read how the goats, you know, if there's a problem, what to do. And
No, Raven, I just want to check. You never did have to deliver a baby that had hoofs, right?
No, I never did. Okay. But I learned a lot from those books, from that book, because there were no quote-unquote obstetric books that were available, mm-hmm. you know. And in 1968, it didn't occur to me to go to Stanford Bookstore and get a book on obstetrics, nor would I have really been able to understand it. Mm-hmm. But the goat husbandry book was the first, and then Barbara Ehrenreich and another person wrote a book called The Rural Handbook for Midwives. It was about a 50-page little softcover book, and it was wonderful. And it was basically for rural midwives.
In China.
And it had so much information that when I began to teach at the Institute of Feminine Arts, I was the teacher for the beginning students. They all came in saying, oh, I've been to five births. Oh, I know this and I know that. And I'd say, great, let's see what we know. And I had a test, like 25 questions, right out of the Rural Manual for Midwives, which was such a simple book. And most everybody couldn't answer them. It's like that book had so much information. And by then, we were meeting. I remember Kate, I had a pelvis of a horse or a cow, and she put it up right into the air. And she was looking through it and say, these are the spines. This is where the biboreal eminences are getting stuck with babies. And those were the kinds of things where we, coming from a non-medical female point of view, hands-on with each other, collectively sharing, we learned. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing because I remember the first birth I did at Stanford the word doula didn't exist, but I went with one of the persons who I had taught childbirth classes to, and she was a single woman. And I went to be her childbirth part, you know, her coach, it was mm-hmm. called. And I remember meeting Don Creevy, who became a wonderful teacher. And he was working at Stanford in OB, and I had just seen one natural birth at home, one, plus I had birthed. And I went up and I said, well, that baby's going to be boy. He says, I said, don't mess with that woman. Please don't mess with her. Just leave her alone. He said, okay, I will. And at some point he says, okay, she's fully dilated. Let's take her into delivery. And I looked at him and said, she won't deliver for 2 hours. She won't deliver until 7 minutes after three. And he looked at me like, who are you? Where are you coming from?
And this was after you had delivered one baby?
No, I had witnessed. Just went to some birth. I didn't even know the woman. But I had given birth about 9 months before. I walked into, and I had a lot of questions that nobody could answer. Uh-huh. I walked into this hippie home birth. There were no skilled people there, and I watched a woman actualize herself and her the making of her family right before my eyes. Mm-hmm. And what I saw was so profound that I left with every question that the doctors couldn't answer, nor could anybody else that I had tried to understand what my questions. All of them were answered by her. And I took that to be like, you know, Bible. It's like, I know what it's like now. I know what it looks like having somebody be in charge of herself. When she needed to move, she moved. When she needed to jackknife her body, she jackknifed. When she needed a quart of water, she drank it.
Yeah.
Right. And that was just so different, because in the hospital, you weren't allowed to drink. You weren't allowed to get out of the bed. You weren't allowed to use gravity, etc. Yeah. And so here, you know, the contrast between birth in captivity and birth in full actualization was like day and night.
Right.
Birth. You know, well, it turns out that that baby at Stanford actually was born within 5 minutes of my prediction. And Dawn said to me, how did you know that? You know, and it was the first moment that I realized I really did learn something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I kind of feel that where we left this conversation at the break, talking about the legality of midwifery, and now we're looking at abortion.
Now we're looking at the personal is political. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the phrases that was batted around a lot in the women's movement, mm-hmm. the second wave. And it's even more true now. I mean, the personal is political. I mean, birth control was illegal. Anything but, quote, the missionary position, making love, was illegal.
Isn't that extraordinary?
I mean, women get to be on their back and men on top. That was the only legal way in many states. Right. So we really need to talk about the big issues politically, because now there is a body of knowledge about midwifery and how women's bodies work, and we can, you know, pass it on.
Well, I want to finish what I had started to say, is that I think that what's going to happen now, I think Christine or Suki asked the question, you know, what are doctors doing? They're calling up lawyers. Are they going to be, you know, handcuffed behind knowing what to, or being able to respond to a woman in need? Mm-hmm. And it would not be surprising at all to me if there were a body of young women who came up, who were political, who were medically oriented or possibly medically trained, and they said, we will provide them. If it means we're breaking the law, we're breaking the law.
Oh, it's happening already.
So, well, exactly. Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I don't know if it's happening the way the birth movement happened, but if it does rise, that's going to bring everything back up to the conversation like birth did.
Well, Raven, actually, I just read an article in Ms. Magazine about Carol Downer. Do you know about her?
Oh, yeah.
And the menstrual extraction sort of sister clubs where women would get together.
We did that.
You talk to it. Okay. So Carol Downer was interviewed. She's still alive, just like the two of you, these wonderful elders who led the way back then. They were like, abortions weren't legal. Well, they figured out how to do it. There was a male doctor, right, who was doing basically menstrual extraction. They learned from him, and then they started doing it in these sister clubs. And I had no idea about this history. I had no idea about the history of what the two of you had accomplished in this region. That is sort of the silver lining, if you want to say, is that with this overturning of Roe v. Wade, it's like overturning of the soil of history and forcing younger women, and I'm not that young, but me and all the women that are younger than me, to really look at the amazing courage and gift and boldness of women like you, like Raven, like Carol Downer, who's just started things, and they're like, we're taking the power back. And mm-hmm. there was this knowledge, though, that you could be arrested. How aware were you of that when you were?
Oh, very.
Very, very, very.
What was that like for you?
The night before I was arrested, I had this chart from Terry Johnson, had been coming to the birth center for her prenatal care. Mm-hmm. And I said, who's going to go to Terry's birth? And no one raised their hand. Right. And I said, she hasn't done her blood work. She hasn't gotten a visit with a doctor to confirm her health and the position of the baby and things that we were asking for in those days. And
whisker twitching time.
Yeah. So. And nobody wanted to go to her birth.
And for our listeners, this is the supposed woman who was giving birth. It was actually a sting operation, right?
It was a sting operation. Yeah. She was pregnant. She said she was due, I forget when. She was 5 months pregnant, not 7 months pregnant. Mm-hmm. And the next morning, her fake husband calls up and says, Terry's in labor. Bring all the midwife and all the equipment you have. Mm. Well, nobody wanted to go. Mm. So the two most junior people went. So anyway, they got arrested, and then they came to the birth center, which was my home, and arrested me as the ringleader, and Raven was taking pictures. No.
Well, Raven was taking pictures. Now, Kate,
they were
you...
looking for Raven. They weren't.
They were there looking for me.
They were looking for Raven, you know, and she, like, ducked.
No, I didn't. They came right up to me. I was standing outside because I was living in British Columbia. I called up Kate, and I said, hey, Kate, what's going on? And she said, they're here. They're here. They're combing through my house with a fine-tooth comb.
We're getting busted.
Yeah, we're getting busted. And so I hung up the phone. I called the newspapers. I called the radio stations. And I went downtown, down into her where she lived, you know, in the city, in Santa Cruz. And meanwhile, everybody was outside of her house. There were probably 30 people within the first half hour. Within the first 45 minutes, there were 40 or 50 people. And there were these plainclothes cops, and they had a photograph of me because I had been interviewed in the Santa Cruz Sentinel. Mm-hmm. And there was a picture of me with my hair very dark and long. And it was kind of a cool morning, and I was wearing a hat with my hair up and a big coat. And they were going around showing people who knew me, saying, do you know her? We're looking for the ringleader. And they would say, no. And the guy came right up to me, looked me in the face, and said, we're looking for her. Have you seen her? And I looked him straight in the face and said, no. And he continued to go. And that was the day I realized a lot of people really do not have eyes in their heads. Because he just passed me by. And as that was happening, Kate was being taken out of the house, and I think maybe your hands were behind you, and there were all these police. And
who was it that was talking to the radio station as this was happening? Was that you, Raven, or you, Kate? Because I did.
Did you, Raven?
I called them up. No, mm-hmm. I didn't talk to them.
Yeah, somebody was there.
That's pretty savvy media handling, right?
Yeah, I was hanging out the window giving, you know, quote, legal advice, and they pulled me in and said, if you don't shut up, we're going to arrest you for practicing law without a license.
A brazen woman, that's what you are.
Right. No kidding. Yeah, you know, so this connecting to now, I'm just, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking that there are just so many more tools, because I'm thinking this is what, 1970?
1974, March 6th.
Okay, 74. And I doubt you had a cordless phone.
So
we didn't have a cordless phone in my house until I was like in college.
We had those phones, the long curly
yes, the long curly cord
that were tangled. And so
I'm imagining you know, having to hold on to the phone. This, of course, is 2022, and I'm thinking, you know, what would you envision now as similar but modern ways that the young people who want to take on this issue can do that? Their bodily autonomy, their right to have appropriate health care, which includes for people with uteruses, it includes abortion, because that is part of appropriate health care. And so I'm imagining a similar scene.
Well, it's going on. It's still going on in the United States. And a lot of it now is from nursing boards and medical boards. So the whole drama of an undercover agent, They modeled it on a drug bust. But I don't know what it would be like now. What, we're going to go on Facebook and
have
videos of how to do menstrual extraction?
Well, well, you know,
I went to Chinese medical school and had a practice for 35 years as a Chinese doctor. And then I, for the last 20 years, I've been teaching OB and pediatrics in the colleges. And my students have said, you got to get this information out, Raven. You got to get it out. Kind of like the birth book. It had to get out. The birth book came very quickly. This has been just a struggle like crazy. I started writing it a long time ago when I was teaching. And just 2 weeks ago, I finished a chapter on miscarriage. And I learned from one of my teachers how to, I mean, it's not vacuum extraction, but you could give needles and you could give herbs, an herbal formula that will start contractions and hopefully to somebody who doesn't have abortion as access, start to make, you know, enough contractions so that she could abort. And this is, I'm writing this and I'm thinking, you can't put this in a book. You can't put this in a textbook. I mean, you know, they'll throw you in jail. And I thought, well, the hell with it. You know, I mean, it's like
To hell with it. It's knowledge. It's freedom of speech.
It's freedom, exactly.
Right. It's like freedom of
speech. If it ever needs to get out, because even when I've taught, I didn't really, I let the students look between the lines. But at this point, after Roe has been overturned, you have to say, no, you don't have to read between the lines. Here are the steps. Here are the herbs.
So let's, you know, we're going to take a quick break and then let's get into that. Let's talk about what, how we can empower younger people with information in this post-Roe era. So we will be right back with Talk of the Bay.
And back to Talk of the Bay, Suki.
Yes, indeed. We are having a really excellent conversation with two women who were midwifery pioneers. We're here in the studio with Kate Boland. On the air, we've got Raven Lang. In this wonderful world where so much that used to be difficult is easy, and that creates its own problems. I work with teenagers, and I can tell you that to a certain extent, our modern life that we who lived without the internet think, oh, it's so convenient, it's so easy for them. There's a lot of downsides, but one of the big upsides is that there is no way to contain, there's no way to contain information now.
Right.
So where, you know, say in Chicago, where the, what was it called? The Janes, the Jane organization, were giving underground abortions and women had to know another woman because they couldn't get that information out. Now there's information everywhere and young women have their fingertips on
the keyboard.
The keyboard, There's also misinformation everywhere.
There's misinformation, but I'll say again, Ms. Magazine is publishing links to very, very detailed information.
So what do you see, Raven, about what from your experience and knowing the world they're in now? And you said, you know, you were worried, oh, maybe I shouldn't publish this, but we're in this world now where there's just so much information out there. What would you say to young women who want to fight back? What should they do?
To think about that. Why don't you say something about that, Kate?
Well, I think young women need to educate themselves. I think somehow we have to get the history out. And so much of the young women are interested in the gender issues, that the women's movement that we were part of, we were the second wave in the 60s and 70s, is so distant history, they don't know anything about it. And there are some really big issues besides your gender. And we're going to get freed up so that it's not so important what gender you are. You're a human being and a person. But those of us who are women, cisgender women, which is most of the females in the world, that whole movement has been lost. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not really a movement anymore. Ms. Magazine came out of that. So I think what has to happen is we have to reclaim the feminine aspects of childbirth and pregnancy and lactation and breastfeeding. We have to re-educate ourselves that there are really profound, deep aspects of being female with a woman breast. And we are persons and we are citizens according to the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So there's no sexual connotation in citizenship. So we really have to stand up and say, hey, we never, for instance, we never ever got maternity care.
Right.
Or maternity leave. We got now family leave, which is only 6 weeks. Now, family leave is for anybody of any gender. And the problem with that is that only women and the few trans men who have a vagina and bleed, women have breasts that are leaking milk and vaginas that are bleeding after birth, and we need to heal, and our babies need us, and mm-hmm. we need to support breastfeeding. I mean, the whole formula thing, the formula shortage. Hey, hello, no one has mentioned breastfeeding as part of the problem. The lack of
having,
breast.
Having the space and the capacity,
the time,
yes.
Yeah, and the financial support to take care of a newborn. Mm-hmm, really right. take care right. in the optimal way.
Yeah.
So,
and you know, speaking of the women's movement, and you're saying that it's been kind of forgotten, and what I would say is like it's come in waves, and I think a lot of women, because some rights had been achieved, we weren't really coming to terms with the courage and the commitment. I don't like war metaphors, so I don't want to say the battle and the fight.
No.
I'm going to say the courage.
Creation. Yeah.
The creation of new ideas, new principles, and having the commitment and the determination to stay with it, because the system has been pushing against women all along, and now the system has risen back on top of us. We're underneath, and so this information.
And they had a strategy.
They had a strategy, and now. Now, this is an opportunity. In every crisis, there is an opportunity. And this is an opportunity for women to claim, for the feminine to claim its whole power. And there's a lot, I think, that a lot of us women had been leaving on the table.
There's some really interesting research that, you know, you mentioned, Kate, that young people have these days have a very, and young people in every age have a very different perception of themselves than the older generations do. But there's been a really big shift in between your generation, Kate and Raven, and our generation, Christine and I, and now the younger generation that are, you know, the ages of my kids in their 20s, and that the word feminism even
It's been disdained.
It's unbelievable. When they did a study of liberal voters, not just everybody, that if you take men the age of my husband, they are very likely, if they're liberal voters, to say that feminism is a good thing.
Right.
And so are the women. When you get down into the 20s, you find that young liberals do not like the word feminism and often don't understand it.
I read that article too. There's a lot of negativity.
Yeah.
A lot of negativity.
Yeah.
So what did you want to say,
Ray? Men. Like the common thing is, well, I don't hate men. I can't be a feminist. Well, excuse me.
Yeah.
Most feminists, you know, give birth.
Yeah, well, and
to boys.
They're involved with men enough to have babies, and they give birth to baby boys.
And we have brothers and fathers and
right,
sons.
Right. And this is part of the strategy that you talked about. This is what I've noticed with extremism in America. Sadly, they're better at seizing the narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We need to tell.
We're all arguing
a better
about
story.
Which gender or how you say.
Well, we need to find a cohesive, generative, life-supporting, inclusive narrative, mm-hmm. a vision that excites people's hearts versus a narrative or a vision that divides us against each other at all. And that takes work to think of it.
It does.
But that's what we need.
Let's work on that in the next
yeah,
seven
exactly.
minutes.
I wanted to ask Raven, it sounded like you wanted to say something at one point. You're at a disadvantage over there on the out
oh, no,
in the
that's
airwaves.
Okay. I don't even remember. I'm just listening to you in the here and now.
So we have this situation where people who wanted to make abortion illegal were very focused, and let's say the numbers loud and clear, they are the extreme minority in this country.
Extreme minority.
Yes.
But they are in control.
But then somebody would say, look, the House, the Senate, and the presidency are all controlled by Democrats.
Not
so
really.
What are you talking
no,
about?
They're not.
No.
No, we got two Republicans that got elected on Democratic tickets as senators. They're not Democrats. They're Republicans, Manchin.
Well, and they're, so because of the way our government works, people look at it and say, well, Democrats are in power. Why can't they do anything? But because of the way our politics work, there was a small group of people who have brought about this enormous change. So Roe v. Wade is gone. And in the last couple minutes we have here, what do you two see as the future, how is your sense of women's place, and not necessarily in California where we are, you know, relatively secure, although I will say that half of California's counties do not have abortion clinics.
Or midwifery care. Or obstetrical care.
Yeah. So what do you see going into the future that we need to do? Just talk, Kate, first. Just talk a little bit about what we need to do.
Well, we need to energize the youth to vote. And we need to clarify the issues. And I don't know how to do that. I'm not a media person. So what do you think?
I'm asking you. Okay, well, but those are two things that are really important to get out there. The vote and understanding that they're, you know, historically young people have a very low voter turnout, especially midterm elections. If all of them turned out for the midterm coming up, we would keep the Senate and the House,
right?
Because they are more likely to vote for liberals. So they don't see their own power. I'll translate that what you said to that perhaps they need to see their own power and
they
get
give
in touch
up
with their
own power.
Power.
They do not seize their power. Why would anybody give up the power of the vote? The most powerful thing we have in a democracy, and without voters, we don't have a democracy. And I don't know how to communicate that, or I don't know how to communicate to the young people or all the non-voters.
Well, taking away a very significant right, like the right to abortion, I think is already galvanizing young people. And you know, it's like the 60s is very romanticized for really, really good reasons. But let's keep in mind that the reason people were marching out on the street is because the young men were going to die. Mm-hmm. People's young brothers were dying. That people don't get galvanized until it comes home to them. And it's come home.
It has come home.
And climate change is bringing it home to a lot of young people. I think there's a lot more involvement. And I would say that, again, this creating connection, telling stories, right? But connecting. And also getting this information out. Like, I think it's incredible for people to understand the high death rates for women when midwifery was illegal. And then the two of you and all the other wonderful women back then campaigned and worked hard and got it legalized, and the death rate contracted by 50%, and helping people understand, if you care about life, care about women.
Exactly. So Raven, we just have 1 minute, 30 seconds.
Education. And I think if women gather together, the women in leadership, even if you're 28 and 31 years old, come together like the birth control movement started in the early part of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And the birth movement started at, you know, in the 60s and 70s. And now I think there will be another movement. I don't think that the people who are taking leadership have to be certified for leadership.
Oh, that's a really good
doctors and lawyers, et cetera. They can yeah. simply be
good
people
point.
Who have a strong passion and aren't afraid to do the work and takes chances.
And I want to add that, you know, we've been talking a lot about women, but one of the things that is so inspiring about young people these days is that because they are seeing gender more expansively, the young men can take those leadership positions too. The young people with penises, and they can take that leadership position too, and they can advocate for those people in our population who have the capacity to create human life inside their bodies. And that's what it's really all about. For and I just want to say thank you so much. This is one of these conversations I'm like, please, no, time, stop, slow down.
Here we are with Kate
Bowman and Raven Lang, and you two have been wonderful. Listeners, please check ksqd.org for a podcast of this show with links to information about that we've discussed, and also links to other shows about the abortion issue that we have been doing here at K-Squid. Thanks for listening, and please return again tomorrow at 5 p.m. for more Talk of the Bay. Thank you, Christine, for being my co-host.
And thank you both hosting us.
Yes, thank you very much.
And do check out the link to the video Birth Happens. Really incredible stuff, people. History in Santa Cruz rocks. All right, now we have first...
Birth Happens. It's on YouTube and also through the San Lorenzo Museum of History.
That's it. All right, and now we have First Person Singular on ksqd.org.
You've been listening to The Babblery. Please visit www.babblery.com for links and information related to this podcast.